Welcome back to the Intellectual Explorers podcast. In today's episode, I had an exploration with James Cirillo. James is the author of a book called Metamodern Leadership, a history of the seven values that will change the world. From my understanding, the precursor for this book was an intellectual journey James went on, reading everything he could about leadership and management, which he became disenchanted with. And this led him, of course, to philosophy. And he settled on this metamodern term to define our era. And after he published it, he was introduced to the rest of the metamodern gang, a group of writers who are currently writing under this label or banner of metamodernism. So metamodernism is this budding intellectual movement. And if you're not familiar with the term, James and I speak about it further in this episode. And I think its intellectual roots stem from Ken Wilber's integral theory. I could be wrong about that. And I'm curious to see how it continues to evolve. And I'm going to invite hopefully more metamodern guests on in the future to have some jam sessions with them. So some housekeeping. I changed the name to the podcast to the Intellectual Explorers Podcast instead of calling it the Intellectual Explorers Club, which is the in-person, which is the name for the in-person club. I changed it to differentiate it from the in-person club because I think it lends itself better, the club word, to in-person rather than on a podcast. Okay, so enjoy this exploration I had with James. This is a club for lovers of Sophia, cartographers of the noosphere, anthropologists of meme plexes, addicts of insight porn, and rebels full of euquakes. We are not idealists or realists, theists or atheists, modernists or postmodernists, liberals or conservatives, progressivists or reactionaries. We may be a mix of all of these things, but first and foremost, we are intellectual explorers. Today, I'm exploring with James Cirillo. Before we begin, I'm going to anchor myself in an exploratory mindset via spoken affirmation. I, Peter, will engage in this dialogue with the spirit of exploration. My intention is not to agree or disagree, but to be a performative agnostic and understand my interlocutor's map of reality and possibly explore new territory together and joyfully appreciate what emerges. That being said, James, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Peter. Good to be here.
So I was somewhat aware of this metamodern meme before I posted that Culture War 2.0 white paper. And I think it was originally associated in my mind with Shia LaBeouf and his collaborations with Luke Turner, if I understand correctly. And I was a big fan of Sir Gil Simpson's Metamodern Sounds of Country Music. But beyond that, I didn't really know what this like metamodern thing was. Then after I released that white paper, all these people calling themselves metamodernists started geeking out over it and reaching out to me. I was interested to introduce to Ronan Harrington, for example, the Listening Society, and your book, to name a few. So I'm a little bit more educated on what metamodernism is, but since you're the first guest I am having on who's kind of representing the label, maybe we can start there and speak about what your understanding of metamodernism is.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, I'm honored to be the first, what you might call metamodernist on the program here. So I feel like I got a lot of lot to cover that I might not be equipped to cover, but I'll do the best I can here. So I'll kind of start out with my understanding of it because, you know, I think there's lots of ways to describe the idea of metamodernism. And like I said, I think it's growing in popularity and idea and an understanding about what the meta term means. In fact, Seth Abramson, who's a Huffington Post writer and he's a college professor, he's got a new book out. He was on Bill Maher last week and Bill Maher actually said the word metamodern metamodernism. So
wow,
it's starting to catch on as an idea. And you know, there's a lot of ways that you can describe it. I like to describe it as a cultural era, because I'm more sociological rather than and sort of an analytical philosopher. So maybe a developmental stage in a cultural era. So I'll just kind of let you know how I got there, and I did get there through like the Loop Turner manifestos and whatnot, and kind of just reading a little bit of what Seth Abramson had written about the metamodern. That he, you know, I think Seth Abramson influenced Sturgill Simpson, who's a, you know, he's a country artist, right. American country artist, and he wrote metamodern sounds and country music, and it's really good if you're into that type of thing. But so it's a, you know, it's this idea of you're increasingly incorporating more complexity, cognitive complexity, that is. In fact, you know, I wrote this book and came out in 2017, and you know, kind of when I finished it, it's called Metamodern Leadership, my book, and kind of when I finished it, is I said, towards the end, I said, what the hell am I doing here? What am I making? What am I doing? So I went back and I said, man, this is some sort of strange philosophy that I've gotten myself into, never really hearing the terms metamodernism or what it was. So I took it from, you know, and this is years ago that I started really doing this, is I took it from the sort of the art world and the literary criticism of these kind of abstract theoretical ideas. And I wrote a qualitative book surrounding, you know, value structures and how they change and how they surface, kind of in the vein of, you know, sociologists like Emile Durkheim or Carl Mannheim, into the context of, you know, 20th century philosophers, and what's a 21st century philosopher mean, and what is it, and is there a new type of philosophy that people can do? And I was like, man, I think I'm doing this metamodernism, whatever the hell that is. So I better learn what came before it, because that's sort of the sort of symbolic development. So let me clear that up, because that might be kind of fuzzy. Right when my book was published, right real close followed after, Hansi Fronick wrote The Listening Society, and he's an analytical philosopher. So he does a really good job of explaining these positivist things, these scientific things that are way beyond the realm that I had the capability to interpret. So really, he says the metamodern is made up of four things. You kind of qualify them four different ways. The first being stage, and that's cognitive complexity. So, and I think I told you this before, Peter. You know, you really understand mimetic tribes and how, you know, your culture war 2.0 really speaks to the 34 different tribes that you've found that exist on the internet, and all their sort of value memes and what they believe. So you know, your metamodernists have a new hierarchy, I would call it. You're reintegrating the relativism or the fragmentation of the postmodern. That might be the best way to think about the foray into the metamodern world. So I mean, stage is the cognitive complexity, because, you know, as time marches on, things get more complex. It's just kind of the nature of time, right? That's sort of a developmental idea. So that's why I say, like, metamodernists can be comprised of developmentalists, and by developmentalists I mean neo Piagetians, who like a Robert Keegan or like a Michael Commons, who have this idea that you need to further have, have continuous development throughout maybe the human life cycle or throughout the continuation of cultural eras as you go. So that's really what the symbolic development is another feature of metamodernism. And that's kind of where you get into the integralists, right? The spiral dynamics,
right?
All the colors and everything. And I'm not an expert at that. That's basically what that is for those who don't know, is that, you have a look, and I'm probably not gonna get the colors right because, but are you familiar with those colors, Peter?
I'm familiar with the original one, the spiral dynamic ones.
Yeah. So it's like, orange and you're
a modernist.
You're blue and you're a modernist. So they kind of assign colors to all this and they understand all the value memes that are wrapped up in that particular code. So it's almost like an operating system that you're born with. The best way to think about it might be I hope I have this right. I'm sure it's more complicated than this, but the Heidegger idea of sign and design. So your sign is just sort of the natural system that you're born into, and that could be your biology, it could be your just your true authentic self, and then the sign is you in a certain time and place, right? And all the social constructs around you that cause you to be cause you to believe, essentially, right?
Right.
Cause you to assign what's good and what's true. And then you have state, of course, and that's more of your psychological development. Are you high state all the time? Are you low state all the time? And high state would be by that, you could probably assign 12 or 13 different values to that. And, if you're the highest state is probably like a Dalai Lama or something, right? Who just goes around enlightened all the time, which is not the state that most people are used to as they go around about their day every day. Mm-hmm. And then the final dimension is depth. So how deep are you? Do you just skim the surface? How deep are you, and what do you get deep in? So what's beautiful to you? What do you see as a mystery in life? What do you see as tragedy, as comedy? These deep existential ideas that are personal to you. I think this isn't more along in the faith of James Fowler. He's a developmentalist, but he studied development of faith. So I think what you keep coming back to in metamodernism is this idea that we're developing. So you're bringing hierarchy back from the relativism of the postmodern world, right? Mm-hmm. Which the postmodern world is just a rejection and a fragmentation and a deconstruction of the Enlightenment project. Everything we put together and thought was true, essentially for a few hundred years.
Hmm. So there's a quote from Luke Turner that I wrote down. I wanted to read it to you and then talk a little bit about this idea of oscillation. So this is the quote. So the metamodernism discourse is thus descriptive rather than prescriptive, an inclusive means of articulating the ongoing developments associated with a structure of feeling for which the vocabulary of postmodern critique is no longer sufficient, but whose future paths have yet to be constructed. And he talks about the sort of like this metamodern is an oscillation between the modern understanding and a postmodern understanding. If I have that right, could you maybe go into that a little bit more? What's this oscillation mean?
That's exactly right. It's an oscillation. It's this new feeling. I think, and Seth Abramson talks a lot about this. I think David Foster Wallace talked about this in the 90s. Is I think he called it like this new feeling, like what's beyond the postmodern and the post-structural. So you can deconstruct into very nihilistic terms, and this is a good. This leads me really well into my idea, because I think what I personally bring to metamodernism is a sense that we can equate generations to cultural eras, and they can have an essence. They can be sort of true, because what we're doing is, you know, if you look at the modern world that maybe lasted 200 or 300 years, or, you know, if you want to break modernism up into a period of late modernism, like maybe 1850 to 1950, you can certainly do that. You know, everything from Marx to the Cultural Revolution in the 1960s. I would, and that's a period that I'm very interested in. You know, I think that's going to be my future project that we've discussed in the past, is, you know, that what happened to that ideological moment, right, in between the, you know, for the 100 years of late modernism into the 1960s and the 1970s, really all the way up into the 1990s, and what you refer to as Cultural War 1.0, right? The early, right, 90s with the Pat Buchanan, and the that's the postmodern period. That's the fragmentation and deconstruction of these new ideas and these new wars that are going on, that are being fought. And so what you have to do essentially is acknowledge the truths that were won in the postmodern. For instance, you know, the civil rights era, the feminist movement, you know, there's new realities that we need to incorporate that, you know, you think that, you know, I think about it like this. This is kind of a funny way to put it, but watch an episode of Leave It to Beaver from the 1950s, right? Mm-hmm. And you're like, yeah, this is a good world, but what's missing? You know, what's missing? You know, of course, there's a lot that's not on the screen that you can interpret from what's going on in the world in the 1950s, a lot of inequalities. And then, so you gotta learn these new truths, but you also can't forget the past, which is why I use on the cover of my book, I use the Janus from Roman mythology. It's the god of gates, or the god of, you know, maybe the god of doorways, where, you know, you're transitioning into this new time. So it's a old man looking to the past and a young man looking to the future. So that's really the essence of generational transition to me, and that's where I get into the millennial generation is, as far as I can tell, pretty synonymous with the values of the metamodern era. Now, that's not to say that they're all metamodern, because metamodernism has to be some sort of a practice or a framework. However, they're essentially they're pretty similar. Hmm.
And I kind of want to quit on a couple of threads, because your book, The Metamodern Leadership, I want to definitely explore that and how you kind of applied the Strasshow generational theory model towards, you know, this term. But there's just kind of like, I just want to kind of express a personal thing as someone who is a millennial, mm-hmm. and you call the millennial like sort of the heroic generation, or potentially the heroic generation. And one thing I experience is like a great hunger for meaning, you know. It's like, and that's kind of like my understanding of, or my superficial understanding of this metamodern phase is sort of like, yeah, we recognize that the postmodern is inadequate. It's not going to provide us what we need, and we can't go back to this modernity. So we have to go to something else, but we don't know what that is. And so it's like that recognition of uncertainty and then the hunger to move forward. So I wanted to inquire into that, because I remember like talking to, you know, previous generations, like my father, for example. It's like, it strikes me that they don't need to go that deep. You know what I mean? Like, to have that kind of ontological existential architecture in their kind of operating system.
And I could be, you know, not being charitable to past generations or not, but I just find that at least people I surround myself with that are in my generation hunger for this meaning.
Yeah. And I'm glad you said that, because I probably didn't wrap up your last question good enough. That's exactly right. Because in the future, in the past, you can always rely on these axiomatic structures to provide a more implicit meaning structure, more implicit value structure.
Right.
And you don't have to create. And I mean, that's what Nietzsche said, you know, 120 years ago, right? That as the world becomes more complex, God's going to die and everybody's going to have to create their own meaning. That's why we have such a meaning crisis in the world, is that everybody's got to create their own meaning, and it causes ideological chaos. And that's why you have 34 mimetic tribes on the internet. The postmodern is really about the cynicism and the nihilism, and that's where you can really equate that. You can overlap that to Generation X, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody that's, you know, born 1964 to 1978, 1979, they're the cynics. They're the, you know, they had to be strong, and they had to sort of, you know, the 1970s, the post-industrial world, you know, things changed. We realized that, you know, the sort of the happy days of the modern world were going away. Things were going to have to change. Right. So, you know, politically, you have a lot of, you know, neoliberal policies and just a lot of different structures. You know, the companies were, you know, that's where I got into, because my book started as a sort of a leadership book, almost like a business book. Like, you know, the best map that I could draw for myself and anybody else who's willing to listen, about how you navigate the world of work, essentially. Well, I mean, you have to incorporate some sort of new meaning to all of this, and that's where you get into the meta modern. You know, this is like exactly what you're saying. Millennials are meaning seekers. Hmm. Because they have to be, because they, you know, as the world changes, and as the world changes more quickly and more exponentially, you have to create your own meaning that much more quickly. And that means you're progressing faster, and you're looking out into the future more, which to every other generation, that is very dangerous and confusing. And that's why millennials have become a meme to themselves. It's like, people just don't understand it, but it's a, you know, in other words, meaning is their armor, where cynicism was the armor for Generation X. Mm. If that makes sense.
It's like the coping mechanism in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. So in the previous generation, like the boomers or whatever, they had like the comfort of relying on an unquestioned or unexamined ideology. Where we're living this, like the Nietzschean open seas phase. Yes. So we got to find, and I think this is sort of like all these mimetic tribes are just, there's many more that we can list in that paper, but sort of like little ships to jump on and so not to drown in this open sea. But we're sort of like, our curse or our opportunity, however you want to frame it, is to wrestle with this meaning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in fact, your analogy of ships, it might've been Luke Turner, who said that, you know, where is the postmodern, you know, you had all these ships and you had to, you know, jump from one ship to the other and you never knew what was the right ship. And, you know, in the metamodern world, you have to pick a ship. You have to believe in something. I think this is something that you and I talked about previously, is, so where does ideology, begin, and where does meaning end, or vice versa? You know, how do you know? How do you know which ship to pick?
And then, like, when we were talking about that, I said, like, you know, we got to come to terms with what ideology and meaning is, right? Yeah. Like, so do you want to go down that rabbit hole, or?
We can sure try. That's it.
So, what's your sense on that?
Man, it's, you know, it's so complicated. you know, to me, you gotta go, because, like, you know, my work essentially is genealogical,
right?
And that kind of means that to understand the present, you got to always go back, and then to understand that, you need to go back again. So it's sort of a historiography of value structures and how you get to it. And so you have to assign an essence to for a cultural era, for instance. I mean, you can't do what I'm doing and not believe that there's some sort of essence around the postmodern. But at the same time, you can't assign value to the essence of that postmodernism, because you'll just wind up seeing it in an ideological way. Mm. Does that make sense?
I think so. Could you rephrase it just so I can?
Yeah, that's kind of a long-winded answer, but in other words, I have to believe that the postmodern is, you could call it a necessary dystopia. You could call it a short period of progress. You could call, you know, there's a lot of ways to define it, but you have to believe that it was necessary. It has to be a developmental stage.
Right.
I think that's really what a lot, you know, metamodernists are disparate. There's a lot of different types and forms and a lot of things that people are after. But you have to believe that you go through these developmental stages and that you're reintegrating a hierarchy that postmodernists believed in radical equality. You have to start assigning a hierarchy, because there's a hierarchy of values. If you want to have a value structure, there's got to be a hierarchy. I mean, that's why Peterson, Jordan Peterson, is doing so well right now as the world's probably foremost public intellectual. He's telling people that. And I think that, you know, there might be some dangers in some of the things that he's saying, but for the most part, you know, you have to look at his essence of what he's doing, and he's doing some of this work. You know, he's a modernist though. And I think we talked about this too. You know, he doesn't even believe that the postmodern should exist. He believes it's pathological and ideological.
Right.
Well, how do you believe that it's essential without believing that you have to believe everything? You know, does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think it makes sense. I'm not sure if I but what's coming to mind is that like a lot of people with integral sensibilities, like a guy like Ken Wilber, he said that the postmodern stage is a necessary stage to go through, and there's like a healthy version of postmodernism, which is like the bridge mm-hmm. to a more integral tier two level of consciousness. And I recognize for my listeners who are not familiar with all this stuff, like this is, we're getting into like really geeky territory here, so you might have to do some Googling. But then there's also what Wilber said, there's like an unhealthy postmodernism. There's like a pathological mean green mean. And then I think the criticism on Peterson from an integral perspective is that he's just focusing on the pathological version, not focusing on the healthy version. And he even himself may be engaging in the healthy version of postmodernism with his perspective, old taking and all that type of stuff. So like, I want to circle back to your question, though, ideology and meaning. Because like, mm-hmm. I think I have a better understanding what ideology means, sort of like a kind of a map of reality in a way that tells you what is and ought to be. But then what's meaning, you know, like what does that, that word mean?
Right.
And like on a very felt sense level, on an emotional level, if you will, like I get it, you know, it's like, I feel it in my bones and I can kind of like distinguish it between other feelings, like more like hedonistic feelings or more pleasure seeking feelings. That feeling for meaning, like that beacon towards being called towards something greater than yourself, it's there, right? So I get it on a visceral level, I think. So I don't know if that distinction helps, and maybe like ideology is sort of like a map over towards or a way to collectively describe this thing that's calling us forth individually or collectively. I don't know if anything, what I just said right there, I didn't articulate it as coherently as I can because I'm putting myself at the edge here, but does anything kind of resonate with you, what I just said?
Yeah, I mean, I think ideology is a, for the most part, most of it, I mean, a lot of it has to do with your personality, your biology, your upbringing, your experiences, essentially, and your social, your social world. That's how you interpret, that's how you map the world. But meaning is going to be the more personal, how you judge, your depth. So your meaning is probably just one aspect of how you see the world. Now, maybe it's the most important part. I'm sure a lot of people would argue that. But it's just how your sensitivities, your perceptions, your sensations, this is the area of Peterson, right? Of the maps of meaning. That's his whole, that's what he spent a decade and a half thinking about. It's how do you make the most fundamentally individual reality that you can possibly make, whereas you wipe out all potential ideologies, all potential pathologies that erupt in the world. How do you beat down, I think he'd probably say something like, how do you kill all the snakes that are causing you chaos? Mm-hmm. How do you do that? That's the search for meaning, like the Viktor Frankl search for, he says the will to meaning is the strongest will for humans, and maybe that's true.
Right. I had a previous guest on, Todd Altucher. He's a philosophical investigator. And he said meaning is something that, you willingly stand out in the rain for, what are you going to suffer for? Right. And that might be the direct way to describe it, but maybe that's a good heuristic to understand when you land on something that's meaningful.
That's exactly right. And getting back to Peterson, I mean, that's, right. Suffering, that's what he goes to, suffering or responsibility, right? Clean your room. I mean, that's what he's teaching young people. Camus say that we must, assume Sisyphus to be happy.
Right.
That, and Sisyphus is a guy that rolls a boulder up a hill and rolls it back down all day, right? That's the like parable, that's the story. You must assume to be happy. So that's I mean, that's the core of meaning, I guess, right?
So there's two threads I want to go down, and I'll let you kind of decide which one resonates more. So we can talk about the Strauss-Howe generational theory model and how you think the millennials map over to it. But I'm also kind of interested going down the thread of how millennials are kind of got a really bad rap. They're lazy, they're entitled, the snowflake generation, all that type of stuff. And I just kind of bought into that narrative, oh yeah, yeah. I'm a millennial, I'm 34, right? But it's yeah, we're lazy, we're entitled in comparison to previous generations. But there's a part of me, I was flirting with this idea that this, what is perceived to be entitlement or laziness or whatever, is sort of a rebellion against bullshit in a way, right? And then this hunger for meaning and being kind of mimetically imprisoned by an old narrative or an old ideology. I haven't had that fully fleshed out yet. So I wanted to throw those two threads out there and which one kind of you want to take the bait on.
Great. Okay. Well, good. Yeah, let me go back to something the Engelhart Wetzel model of kind of mapping the value structure of the world. I don't know if you ever heard of that sociological map. It's an XY axis.
Okay.
That says the world is, you know, you got an XY axis of from tradition, from religious, I guess, traditional values to secular values.
Right.
And then from more authoritarian to more self-expression on the Y axis. So okay. It's essentially the same thing as the political compass, right? The left, right, and the authoritarian and the libertarian idea. You know, you're these quadrants that you could probably group things in. But the Engelhard Wetzel, I hope I'm saying that right, map says that, you know, the top right of the XY axis are these Nordic countries. And I believe that's what this next book that Hansi Freinich is going to come out with, the Nordic ideology. And it's saying that, you know, a lot of the younger people, you know, call millennials, call them Gen Z, call them whatever you want to call them, they see that we've come to a point in the development of history where we can start to engineer some sort of well-being. So, and whenever you start to hear the transformation and the engineering and the possibilities and the creativity and the moving forward, I mean, to half the world, at least, or, you know, it's like, whoa, these kids are going to come in and change everything. And we're going to lose all of our foundational history and our values. And that's, it's a threat. It's a big threat. I mean, look at AOC, perfect example. You know, 29-year-old New York state congresswoman, for those who don't know who she is or might not be American, but I mean, she's a lightning bolt, and she's the, you know, she might as well be the person I wrote my book about, Metamodern Leadership. I mean, she's encompasses all these values of what the essence of this metamodern leadership is. I mean, I believe that there is sort of an essence here, which is why I wrote the book in the first place. And, you know, she believes that, like a lot of millennials do, you know, she's a social, you know, she believes in social democracy, which, let me finish my thought about the map here, is the top right corner is all the Nordic countries, you know, your Sweden and Finland and the Netherlands, and they have the highest secular values and the highest self-expression values. And, you know, your bottom left is going to be your least free countries, which are, you know, some of your African countries, some Middle Eastern countries that just don't allow the freedom of expression. So really what, and how that's all mapped, is a sociological research into the well-being of people. You know, how well are you doing mentally? How well are you doing physically? How well are you doing financially? And so you can start to determine what well-being is. You know, as soon as you go over to happiness and start trying to, you know, I think that's a mistake, because, you know, then you start to, you can easily get into kind of a utopian trap of ideology. So, but well-being seems to be the most objective way to form a new society, or to at least change things. And it's all surrounding meaning. And I think millennials are realizing that, and it's going to scare people.
And what is your understanding of well-being and how it differs from happiness?
Well, you know, I think you can, you know, it kind of goes back to what we were just talking about with meaning. You know, you can go to your job rolling a rock up a hill for 8 hours and get paid well and be able to have the, you know, the time with your family or whatever's important to you. But, you know, is that happiness? It's, let me think of a better way to answer that question.
You know, something that's coming to mind is that, there's this, I don't know if you heard this term, it's called ikigai. I think that's how you pronounce it. It's like reason for being. It's like a Japanese term. And there's like this really interesting image. There's like a four kind of quadrant type thing. And then you know your reason for being if you hit on all these four areas. So like something that pays you money, right? So something that supports a livelihood. Something that you're good at, right? That you can do well. Something that that excites you, that brings you joy, right? And then the last one is what's something that the world actually needs, something that brings genuine value. And if you can kind of land on all those ones, like if you just have one or two, then one might be a vocation, one might be a career, one might be a job. But if you land on all of them, you found your ikigai, right? And I really like that sort of at those intersection, because it's like if I can get all of those four, then why not? You know?
Yeah, I that's great. I've never come across that that idea before, but that's exactly right. I mean, what comes to mind is the Easterlin paradox, which says that, you know, after you make a certain amount of money, you stop getting happy.
Right.
You know,
right.
That's a kind of a you know, we're in the Western world at least, you kind of get to a point where it's like, you know, people still are wanting to have a good job for security or, you know, various reasons. But at some point you develop so much that, you know, you start to have other things that are important to you, you know?
Right.
So that's why it's such a, post Marxist idea that, you know, we're way past the Marxism at this point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So did you want to go down the generational theory, or do you want to continue with the millennial thread about, you know, other?
I can, you know, the generational theory it's interesting. I don't know how scientific it's going to be, but right. Qualitatively, the Smith-Howe model says that there are four generational archetypes that repeat over the, and they take this back to the United States to the 16th century. You know, and they say that you have, because a natural human lifespan is made up of about 80 years, mm-hmm. you have four periods within the human lifespan, essentially four generations. So because all the firsthand knowledge is gone within 80 years, you turn over to a new, series of generations. So in other words, there's only four generational archetypes, and they just repeat themselves on and on through history. So you have the the baby boomers are an archetype. The Gen X is an archetype, and then the millennials are an archetype, and their particular archetype is the heroic sort of generation. They come in and clean up the mess, so to speak, of the revolution that was caused by the baby boomers, you know, because that's really what it was. And I think even the people who are generally turned off to talk in any sort of sociological terms, will even say that yes, objectively, the 1960s was a cultural revolution. Hmm. So you have each of these generations rebelling against the previous value structures of the previous generation. So it's just this constant battle for equilibrium, essentially. And Williams and Drew, I think the name of these people, these researchers, they even simplified that idea further. It's just a battle between the me and we constantly in a pendulum. And this kind of goes back to your question about oscillation. What is, you know, how do things oscillate between generational periods or historical eras? And it's like, maybe it's as simple is that the prevailing idea is the tension of the me versus the tension of the we.
Hmm. I like that.
Because, you know, think about the millennial generation archetypically is the same thing as the GI generation that fought World War II. So, you know, they were a collective minded generation. I mean, they had to be. They had to come together for the war effort. And, you know, everybody pitched in. And, you know, by the time of like Gen X, for instance, you didn't need, you know, that all that collectivism was gone. You're just out there on your own trying to scavenge in a post-industrial world. And, you know, for decades trying to kind of bring it all back together. And then, you know, I think the technologies of the digital revolution that have been going on for 20 years make it possible. I mean, social media makes it possible for people to get back together. But the problem is getting back together means that there's fragmentation in that process itself.
And so I wonder if you can elaborate a little bit more on the millennials as the heroic generation and what kind of characteristics do they embody or can embody?
I talked about this on the with Daniel Dorson on his podcast, and I think that's something that is important to have these ideas of fight against these memes of entitlement and laziness. And you know, I think that their heroicism, the millennial heroicism, lies in being able to fight the battle from within, so to speak. Because they're not revolutionaries. They're not going to go out and tear down structures. In case you haven't noticed, there's not giant protests in the streets of the United States about Social Security, for instance, or their economic well-being, and you know they're not banding together in huge waves with demands in the streets like the boomers did during Vietnam. You know, this is not what they do. So they're slowly. They're oscillating. They're embracing culture and they're changing culture from the inside. And would you call that heroicism? Well, you know, some might see that, you know, that method of leadership doesn't really strike people as being a leader. It doesn't, a lot of people don't see that as leadership at all. It's more of a weakness maybe. But I think they see it as a certain advantage, as a certain power, because they can, get into groups and change things, because, you know, the power of groups is more important than it's ever been. And it's also potentially the most dangerous than it's ever been.
Right, right. So you mentioned that they're not kind of like gathering and protesting. And, you know, what comes to mind is like Occupy or Me Too or the Extinction Rebellion. And it's more like focused on certain areas, like, you know, either corporate greed or harassment or, you know, environmental crises. So do you see that millennials are involved in these protests, or do you think that's sort of, they're impotent in a way?
I'm not going to speak for all millennials. And by the way, I don't consider myself a millennial or a Gen Xer. I'm kind of bridge the divide. I was born in 1979. So
right
there on the cusp of each. So I think I have a barely objective viewpoint of each generation. But I think that, you know, some are just like any other generation. I mean, I think they have an essence, but individually, you know, some are going out and doing these things. But I think for the most part, a lot of them are just kind of fitting in and slowly changing things. The best example of this to me is the workplace.
Right.
You know,
right.
When you get a new batch of millennials in the workplace, it's like, you better figure this thing out, because they're going to be motivated by completely different things than your last group of employees did.
Well, this is something I wanted to inquire with, because one of the buzzes is employee engagement, right, in the workforce, and just to kind of like share, maybe to go back a little bit, like when I was younger. And I was working in a corporate setting. I was working at the University of, maybe I shouldn't say where I was working, but anyways, I was working in a certain environment. And, I just felt that it was sort of what David Graeber called like a bullshit job, right? Mm-hmm. And I had to like do a Herculean effort just to not procrastinate, and the desire to procrastinate was there and all that type of stuff. And then there was like a real deep feeling of like a shame associated with that, right? Like an inadequacy, like, oh, I can't bootstrap as easy as someone like, you know, my father or people in that generation could do it. Like I rebelled against it. And so there was a feeling of like a judgment there on myself. But now looking back at it, it's like, man, you know, that job when I had in my, you know, early to mid 20s was like, wasn't needed. You know, it's going to be automated in a couple of years. It could be easily replaced. It was probably just a bullshit job type thing. And so having that frame, and maybe I'm just being a little bit too patting myself on the back or this generation on the back, but it's sort of like, you know, a hunger for meaning doesn't want you to kind of neuter yourself getting good at something that's not required, right? That's not that the world doesn't need. And so I really like this frame of the heroic generation. And I remember I was invited to like a private dinner party. It was mostly these with the rationalist or effective altruists. And they're sort of like flirting with developing a political party to unite against existential risks, X-risks, you know, like whether it's the artificial general intelligence, you know, how super intelligence and the misalignment problem or environmental crisis. It's like that really excited me, because shit, this is what the world needs right now, right? And now that I have I got married recently, want to start a family, it's like, you know, there's a lot on the line here. And I don't see people collectively, like the elders, like the Joe Biden just got in the race. And I'm like, he just seems so like painfully out of touch, like on so many levels, this like kind of like unchecked boomer optimism. And I'm going on a little bit of a rant here, but I want to know if anything comes up for you.
Yeah, well, no, I agree. I mean, you know, there's a I think he's a technologist. His name's John Seely Brown. I wrote about this in my book. He said that, you know, whereas boomers had, you know, basically one skill set to retire with a pension, a lot of times. Millennials and people that, you know, are starting out in the workforce now, you're going to need five disparate and diverse skill sets to make it last your entire lifetime. Hmm. So you're going to absolutely require continuous learning. It's going to, you know, development is going to be baked in to your career approach. It has to be. And, you know, technology kind of just sits right on top of all that. So it's a way different reality and a way different existential crisis and angst. And, you know, that's why you have a lot of they call it the millennial burnout. Everybody's like, oh, bullshit. There's nothing to be burned out about. It's like, well, you know, it's a constant battle of keeping up. You know, you do your job, whatever that job is. But, you know, on the back end, you always have to be preparing for that next job. Right. And I think that's a reality that, you know, maybe people in the past didn't have a as strong of a necessity, and it didn't cause them as much angst. I don't know. Do you agree with that?
The fact that there's like almost a future shock with the career, right? You don't know what your the next job is going to be, and that anxiety that's associated with that. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah. I mean, there's always, there's always going to be a, future shock is a good way to put it.
It's like one thing I wanted to mention or talk to you about with millennials and meaning and stuff like that was this term that I was introduced recently called existential labor. Have you heard about this?
No.
It's pretty cool. It's like, it's the idea, like, you know how we were talking about, like, there's a buzzword amongst management consultants and learning and development specialists is, you know, let's get some employee engagement, especially with millennials. Like, how do we do that? Right. And then if we're operating on the premise that, you know, there's a meaning crisis and millennials hunger for meaning, then, you know, the one avenue is to, okay, let's inject some meaning into their work. Right. But then if you do it artificially, then what occurs is what this paper called existential labor. And they had like two kind of interesting terms. They call it surface existential acting is when like an employee sort of acts with like on the surface, superficially in alignment with the corporate values or the corporate meaning. And then deep existential acting is when the employee attempts to kind of alter, it's like method acting, something that's meaningful. So they tend to alter their kind of inner sense of what is meaningful in order to align with the employer. And if you do that, then, and if they don't work out, which a lot of the times it doesn't, I imagine, then there's that burnout that occurs. But then you're like, well, why are you burning out for? You? The work's not that hard in comparison to like, you know, working in a coal mine or something like that. So from your like engagement with leadership and all theory and all that stuff, is that, do you think that existential labor or thing is real?
I like that, and I haven't heard of that, but that does make sense. I mean, that what comes to mind is the what's the idea that the humanist psychologist Carl Rogers said? It's not authenticity, but it's acting. You know, that tradition says that you need to act on your most true self, and that's the way to meaning. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be if you get somebody that's trying to engineer meaning into your job, it's going to have the exact opposite effect.
It's like we got a bunch of boomers trying to engineer meaning for the millennials.
That's where it, you know, and I read so many when I first started this, you know, every book out there when I was trying to understand the millennial generation and the dynamics between boomers and the millennial generation, which to me is the biggest systematic change, especially in the workplace, is that, you know, you got 80 million baby boomers are about to retire, and all their leadership spots across all industries, institutions are going to be fulfilled mostly by baby boomers, by millennials very soon. So
right.
They're going to almost replace each other. You know, Gen X is a small generation. Numbers wise, so not that they're not going to be important in the framework, but what we're essentially going to be doing over the next, you know, 10 years is replacing the boomers with the millennials, and I don't think anybody's really woken up to that reality yet.
Yeah, that's going to be fascinating to witness, especially with this. If this is true, what we're saying, that millennials, there's this sort of impulse towards meaning. How is that going to transform? Then this goes lends itself to what you were saying earlier, how it's going to be transformed from within, not without.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. There's not going to be a systematic revolution just because, I mean, the boomers they're still going to vote. There's not going to be a political revolution by the millennials. Now you might have like in the case of AOC and some of these younger millennials that are starting to get into leadership, you know, Congress. And I mean, you know, this is, she's just the tip of the iceberg. Now you hope that, you know, there'll be more the mainstream, because I mean, it's pretty radical. You know, her entering is pretty radical. I mean, it will be tampered down and mainstreamed, her sort of message over time. But as of right now, it seems to be pretty radical to people.
Yeah, and there's not that as many gatekeepers, media gatekeepers, because she has direct access to her audience.
Right.
So, like, we passed the hour mark. Well, at the hour mark, at least on my end, a little bit short for time, because I have to leave around 11. But is there anything kind of like you want to, closing thoughts to leave the listener with?
Well, I mean, nothing other than, you know, my book, if you're interested in this kind of thing, I just let you know, it's a odyssey of 15 different disciplines that, you know, you're required potentially as a millennial to navigate, to kind of map reality in the 21st century. And it has something to do with this idea of metamodernism. So, you know, am I a metamodernist? I don't know. I mean, I know there's a group that calls themselves metamodernists. It certainly seems to me to be the most encompassing idea of emerging structures that I can find. So if you're interested in that, my book's called, Metamodern Leadership. Or if you have any, you know, if anybody, my email is jamesirwillow@gmail.com. If anybody has any questions or wants to engage in anything, I'm on Twitter. So, yeah, that's about all I have.
Cool. Well, James, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I know it was a little bit of we went all over the place, but I think we covered some good stuff.
We did, but it was good. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. All right, everyone. Until next time, keep exploring. All right, boom.
Cool, man.